Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
The great thing about the CSA is that artists get paid. Artists are going to be guaranteed 30 sales.
Taking the farm share model and applying it to the local art scene. A special story from arts reporter Yael Cassander coming up today. Tofu instead of oil, that's the quirky thing about Daniel Orr's Rui recipe. From Harvest Public Media, some farmers are planting cover crops in their soybean fields to help prevent nitrates from seeping into the water supply. Then insects for dinner, the final installment in their Choice Cuts series. And then baby food throughout the years with author Amy Bentley. We have an interesting conversation with her about the invention of baby food in the 20s and then what parents are feeding their infants today. Mark Chilla with us. Let's see what food news had for us this week.
Now you can have your morning coffee and your toast at the same time. Steam caffeinated peanut butter hit the grocery store shelves early last month. The company says every tablespoon contains about the equivalent of one cup of coffee. Now U.S. Senator Charles Schumer has asked the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to conduct a thorough investigation of the product and to consider more regulations of pepped-up foods. The FDA does not require companies to list the amount of caffeine in food products, but the company complies with existing regulations and has gone out of its way to label contents clearly and to post warnings against eating the product during pregnancy. Steam says it markets to athletes who want the extra energy boost with slow-burning protein and does not target children. Officials were talking about the future of hemp in Indiana at a meeting this week. The state legalized the growing of hemp last year, but the crop has not taken off. According to Indiana Public Media, there are several obstacles preventing hemp from going mainstream on Indiana farms. Among them is a complex set of regulations and permissions farmers have to get through to grow the plant. George Blankenbaker is a member of the Indiana Hemp Industries Association Board of Directors. He says another challenge is education. Too many people, he says, still equate hemp with marijuana. The public perception problem often rears its head in the political arena, where he says politicians have been supportive in private, but too worried to publicly champion the cause due to its connection with marijuana. And the FDA is asking for public comment on whether it is appropriate to define the word natural as it appears on food labels. And if so, what should that word mean? This is not the first time officials have attempted to define natural on food labels. In the mid-1970s, the Federal Trade Commission defined a natural food item as one, quote, with no artificial ingredients and only minimal processing, unquote. The FTC's definition fell by the wayside in 1983. The FDA started its own search for a definition in 1991, but the project stalled. Now the FDA is reviving the effort in part due to citizen petitions requesting the term be defined, as well as concerns over whether foods containing GMOs or high fructose corn syrup can be considered natural. Public comments will be accepted starting November 12th. Do check out these articles on our website and share them on your Facebook and Twitter. They're collected at eartheats.org.
That's right. Chad Bouchard and Liz Leslie make news stories happen for us weekly, and Mark Chilla does the reading. Thanks.
Glad to do it.
Farmers put nitrogen fertilizer on their fields to grow bigger, better crops. But when there's too much left behind in the soil, it can pollute water supplies as nitrates. That problem has grabbed some headlines thanks to a big city lawsuit in Iowa. But as Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports, many small towns across the Midwest have the same problem.
Earlier this year, the city of Des Moines, Iowa made news when its water system launched a legal battle with farmers over fertilizer.
The Des Moines Water Works has announced it will sue three neighboring counties, claiming
too much nitrate can be a health risk, especially for infants just a few months old. And
nitrate levels got so high earlier this summer that it cost $7,000 a day to remove the nitrates from the water to meet drinking water quality standards.
But Des Moines is unusual. In most cases, nitrate pollution is not a big city problem. It's a small town problem. And in a small town I visited, it's one they struggle to pay for. I'm in the Water Treatment Center in Creighton, Nebraska, home of their $1.3 million reverse osmosis machine. It's like a stack of 20-foot-long plastic tubes. It takes well water contaminated with nitrates and makes it safe to drink, around 300,000 gallons per day since 1993.
I'm Kevin Sonningson, City of Creighton. I'm the water operator. Our nitrates coming in is 17 parts per million. 10 is the legal limit.
Nitrates can come from your lawn or even the atmosphere. But Creighton is rural, surrounded by farms. Farmers often put on more fertilizer than their crops can use. Then rain or irrigation water can carry the nitrates down into the groundwater supply. And the problem is getting worse, not better. Sonickson says a plume of groundwater with even higher nitrate levels is moving toward the town's wells, and they may need to add more filters.
Our nitrates could be higher where we'd have to put another skid or two in here just to take care of the nitrates.
Any idea what that could cost?
Probably a new system now, $3 to $4 million, easy.
$3 to $4 million for a town of just 1,200 people. Hundreds of small towns in the Midwest have nitrate levels near or over the federal limits. Towns like Burlington, Colorado, Sherdan, Iowa, Edgar, Nebraska, and Pretty Prairie, Kansas.
Nitrates in drinking water are the most common source water problem in the region.
Bruce Dvorak studies small town water systems at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln.
And for many small towns, this is a very major cost issue. It may mean water rates, if they're lucky, only double, and in some cases it may go up by 8 to 10 times.
And even though these small towns have the same nitrate problem as Des Moines, Dvorak says it would be hard to find one willing to take the issue to court.
Most small towns don't have the finances to run the legal challenges, as well as politically, I'm not sure it really would be sustainable in many small towns here in Nebraska. Clearly, the farmers are the lifeblood of these communities.
Towns like Creighton need farmers to produce, and for that, farmers will use fertilizers. But there are different ways to do it. Farmer Jim Fuchtman lives and farms just outside of town. He walks into a field scattered with slender green blades of grass.
This is a field where I had soybeans, and then we planted a cover crop of rye.
The ryegrass will hold nitrates near the surface, away from the groundwater. It's Fuchtman's first run with cover crops, part of a voluntary project in the Brazil Creek watershed, encouraging practices that reduce nitrate levels.
Soil health is my main objective. And with soil health, your nitrates don't leach as fast. You're getting better utilization of the chemicals.
Changes on the farm should show up in the water, but not right away. Significant improvements in groundwater can take 10, 20, 30 years to show up. So Creighton's water treatment plant will probably still be running for decades to come. Kevin Sonickson can't imagine the town suing local farmers like Des Moines, but he says many farmers will find their own motivation. He's tested water for rural residents, and some samples are 4 to 5 times the legal limit for nitrates.
I mean, it's not just for the good of our city, but for them too, and their kids.
And if enough farmers take action, perhaps neighboring towns won't have to bear the same cost for safe water. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Later on today from Harvest, why the future of meat might involve less and less livestock. Community-supported agriculture is a great way to support local growers and get some fresh veggies in the process. Now imagine applying the CSA model to an arts community. That's what one Bloomington, Indiana organization has started doing. Yael Cassander brings us the story.
E.J. Ernsberger remembers his experiences as a CSA shareholder with fondness.
Every time I've done a crop CSA, I was super excited to see what new vegetable was going to come into that share that week.
A CSA, which stands for Community Supported Agriculture, is a way for farmers to ensure a market for their goods. Mark Need explains.
Typically, one farmer organizes a group of farmers and they all contribute portions from their farms to the CSA, and families buy a family share in the CSA.
And every week during the growing season, the shareholder picks up a box of fresh produce that represents what the member farms are growing.
Part of the fun was to see the same people at the pickup days, and people exchanged recipes about what they might make with that week's share, because you didn't know exactly what the share was going to be until you showed up.
Mark built that element of surprise and the sociability of pickup day into his new nonprofit.
CSAB, but the A is art instead of agriculture.
For CSAB's initial offering, 30 shares are available at $300 apiece. The share gets you three original pieces of art by three different artists and an invitation to a private VIP member event to pick up the artwork and get to know the artists.
We have artists with recognizable reputations, and you don't know exactly what you're going to get, but you're counting on the quality of the art based on the artists that are contributing.
So there's a deep sense of trust that underlies the adventurousness here, very similar to a willingness to accept rutabagas or raspberries in your CSA box.
They sort of count on the integrity and reputation of the farmers to know that they don't know exactly what they're getting in their share, but they're comfortable that they're going to get good produce, fresh produce, and something interesting to bring home into their kitchens.
When Mark was describing it to me, he started to describe the different styles of art that were going to be available in the share.
E.J. Ernsberger is a charter CSAB shareholder.
And I just told him to stop right there, that I really didn't care. It didn't matter, because whatever it is going to be fun and interesting.
You're doing a trust fall a little bit, right?
That's a great term, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
E.J.'s trust fall speaks to his belief in the relevance of CSAB's mission to support the visual arts.
I very much appreciate Mark and company creating a way for people to purchase art and for the artist to get paid, yeah, because that pathway is very, very difficult.
The reason I was interested in it is the system for showing and selling art, I feel, is broken.
Printmaker Jeremy Sweet is one of the three artists creating 30 new works of art for CSAB's inaugural offering. He's also the associate director of the Grunewald Gallery at IU and a freelance curator.
The great thing about the CSA is that artists get paid. Artists are going to be guaranteed 30 sales. It's rare that you go into a show and you make 30 pieces and they're all going to sell.
And it's not only the artist who has to take that sort of risk. Unlike a theater or a concert hall, an art gallery normally doesn't charge admission.
People go to art shows and they expect to be fed. They expect to be drinking free wine, potentially. That's a lose-lose right out the gate, because the gallery is expected to front all this money and keep their fingers crossed that someone's going to buy art.
The CSA model, on the other hand, spreads the investment among the shareholders, who are rewarded with the VIP event along with the opportunity to acquire artwork at a significant discount.
It's a win-win for collectors, because we're giving them an opportunity to get work at wholesale, and then the artists benefit because they're selling every piece. So by artists taking a little bit less and selling every one of their pieces, they benefit not only from the income from every sale, but also the exposure of getting 30 pieces on collectors' walls. So we're connecting collectors with artists, and we're hoping that both of them are getting a great deal.
We tried to build the model and scale it at a level where it would be affordable enough from the shareholders' perspective that it was a calculated gamble at the worst.
Mark Need's art selling model took its inspiration from the world of food. Its success may depend on enough shareholders who bring the same sense of adventure to collecting art as EJ does to dining out.
I will often go to a restaurant and ask a few basic questions about what's fresh or what's new. And often you'll find that the wait staff is excited about something brand new in the restaurant that someone's just created. I'm like, all right, bring it. And they'll say, don't you want a description? I'm like, why? You're excited. That's what I want to eat.
For Earth Eats, I'm Yael Cassander.
Coming up, the state of baby food in America.
The practice that's been in favor for a while is introduce food slowly, one at a time.
But author Amy Bentley says some pediatricians are offering different advice that could, again, change how we feed our babies. She traces baby food back to its creation, just ahead. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
Earth Eats. Hello, I'm Annie Corrigan. Kitchen time now with Chef Daniel Orr.
I'm going to take you guys at Earth Eats on a trip to the south of France today, where it's the land of Rouille. Rouille is the old French dialect or called Provençal for rust. So this is kind of a rust-colored sauce, and most traditionally known as the accompaniment to bouillabaisse, which is the classic Marseillaise fish soup, which has, you know, about 15 or 20 different kinds of fish and shellfish in it. One of the bases of the dish, which gives it part of its color, is saffron. And what we're going to do today, you can see they're like little filaments, little hairs. We're going to take a little bit of hot water, and we're going to pour that on top. And you can see how that yellow comes out right away. And we're going to let that steep in there for a few minutes. Now today, instead of the classic, which takes a lot of oil, we are going to use some tofu in this that I've diced up. I'm going to use about a half a pound. And to that, I'm going to add some garlic. It's going to be raw, so it's going to be quite strong. Okay, we're going to add one half russet potato that we've cooked and scooped out of the skin. And that's going to help give us the thickness and give the body to the rouille. And now we're going to start building the flavors. So I'm going to add some chili powder. And then we're going to add about 10 drops of Tabasco. Give us a little more heat. Since we are using that tofu, we're going to need less oil. Usually it's about, to this amount, it would be about 2 cups of oil. So we're only going to use about 3 tablespoons. I'm going to add a half of a medium-sized tomato. And then finally, you can see how that saffron has really perfumed out to a nice orange-yellow color. That real floral aroma. We're going to dump that in with the water. Okay, and I'm going to start this on low. Increase the speed up. Turn it off and give it a stir. Perfect. Put it in the fridge and use it whenever we want. I think you'll come up with 101 ways to use this.
The recipe and a picture of rouille-covered potatoes at eartheats.org. It takes a massive amount of resources to produce our beef, chicken, and pork. That's why some savvy entrepreneurs are ready to offer up alternatives with lighter environmental footprints. In the final story of Harvest Public Media's series Choice Cuts Meat in America, Luke Runyon takes a look at what the future could bring for businesses trying to push traditionally raised meat off the dinner plate.
There it goes.
Taylor Ferguson is an aspiring rancher in West Denver.
Well, I mean, this is it.
He's walking through a hot, humid metal shipping container in the city's Westwood neighborhood.
Right now, it's not terribly glamorous.
In a few months, this box will be his ranch.
There will be like a wall here and a door. And when you open this door, you'll walk into our farm, which is just shelves of crickets.
Yeah, he said crickets. Ferguson and his business partner Wendy Lou McGill are starting Colorado's first cricket and mealworm farm, where the insects are grown for people to eat, not as bait for fish. McGill calls them micro livestock, and they already have customers lined up to buy them.
It's a food. It's not a food that's in our culture currently, but it is a food, and it's a food for a lot of people around the world.
The people pushing insect cuisine make compelling arguments. They say insects are high in protein and calcium, and they're easier on the environment, requiring fewer inputs than other protein sources. They produce a lot less waste. Even the United Nations is on board with the idea. But if taking a bite of your first cricket taco makes your stomach turn, there's a whole other industry churning out products meant to look and taste just like the meats you're used to.
As you kind of see as I form it, I mean, it really holds its shape, so if you want to make, you know, a meatball or something like that.
Devin Bruntz is a food scientist at Rodel Inc. in Fort Collins, Colorado. He's in the company's test kitchen, forming a brown, soy-based mush into a patty.
Yeah, or you can just throw it in a pan, ground it like that, and then you got ground meatless meat.
Brunt's company takes the tack of meat mimicry. There's no point in reinventing the wheel, Brunt says. Give grocery store shoppers something that tastes like beef without the baggage. But that's easier said than done.
Everything you can imagine we failed on. It never gets any easier hearing somebody go, ugh, when they taste something you just created that you thought was all right.
But for all the innovation, the sales of protein alternatives still pale in comparison to the money spent on traditionally raised meat. Think of the average person's protein consumption as a pie chart. The biggest pieces of that pie are poultry, beef, and pork. Then there's the teeny tiny sliver, so small you can barely see it, devoted to meat alternatives like Brunt's soy-based hamburger.
Do I ever think it's going to overtake pork, chicken, or beef? I don't think in my lifetime. But do I think it's going to become a bigger piece of the pie? Yeah.
But with more businesses popping up to fill this growing niche, just how big could that piece of the pie get?
Boy, that's a $64 billion question that nobody knows the answer to yet.
Maureen Ogle is an historian and the author of the book In Meat We Trust, which charts Americans' carnivorous diets over the decades.
The only thing that will make lab meats mainstream will be some fundamental shift in culture or possibly in climate that simply makes meat production too politically or too economically expensive.
Ogle says other savvy entrepreneurs have attempted to sway Americans away from meat throughout history, to little success. But she says right now there's unparalleled momentum toward protein alternatives, with millions of dollars being pumped into plant-based burger companies and laboratories where chicken and beef cultures are grown in petri dishes.
We could be on the cusp of a shift where people will finally stop eating so much meat.
But that shift, Ogle says, will depend on much larger cultural, economic, and environmental factors far beyond the scope of your average startup cricket farm. And it probably won't happen anytime soon. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Hope you'll take a moment today to check out all the reporting posted at Harvest Public Media. It took Amy Bentley 19 years to write her book, Inventing Baby Food. She worked on it sporadically while she was raising her kids. Now those kids are all grown up, so it was time to finish the book. And she's glad she waited so long. Developments in baby food in the last 10 years, she says, completes the story in a really interesting way. She visited Earth Eats last fall to talk about baby food through the years. And starting on page 10, you have this graph here that sort of sets up the entire argument for the book. I found myself referring back to this over and over. And what it shows is at what age babies were first given solid foods. Starts in 1880, and they're 11 months in age. And then it goes to 2000, and we see that babies are 5 months average when they get solid food. Summarize what you're trying to tell us with how the trends change over the years.
Yeah. The graph is telling because it starts in the late 1800s, as you said, and babies are first given solid foods about 9 to 12 months of age, sort of when teeth appear. It was thought that, you know, that was an appropriate time to start solids. And the first foods were soft foods, gruels, beef broth, scraped beef. There wasn't really a category called baby food. There was just this category of soft food that was designed for babies, invalids, sick people, anybody who needed sort of a softer, blander diet. Those were the first foods that were given at that time, 9 to 12 months. When you get the rise of industrialization, the manufacturing and proliferation of baby food, then that age of introduction of solids starts to decline. And between the 1920s and the 1950s, it just sharply drops. So by the post-World War II era, the average age of introducing solids was 4 to 6 weeks.
So now the pushback comes in the 70s. So we're thinking consumer activism is starting to happen. The beginning of the food movement is starting to come around. This idea of natural motherhood and making your own baby food. Describe what you mean by natural motherhood.
This is part of the whole counterculture 70s that is exploring new alternative ways to live, and food is one of the things they're exploring. And so in the early part of the 20th century, the ethos was a scientific motherhood. And that was, you are not capable of taking care of your child without the realm of science and the world of experts. But in the 1970s, you have a different ethos, and that this ethos is what's called natural motherhood, and that this is the exact opposite. Trust your own instincts, distrust science, distrust the experts. And so food is one of the things that where this is played out. And so a lot of people are seeing the commercial baby food as unhealthy and so are turning to making their own as the alternative.
You would think that after everything that we've been talking about, backlash in the 70s, now the food movement is in full effect right now. You'd think that commercial baby food, as you know, they knew it in the 30s, would be long gone. Not so. In 2011, Americans spent $6.2 billion on baby food. That's a figure from your book. Gerber had 3/4 of that market share. But now we're seeing some small-scale baby food manufacturers come on the scene. Let's talk about these new players and how they're changing the game.
Yeah. In the 2000s, before the recession in 2008, there were several small startup companies, and it was the right time for them to produce a different kind of baby food. They were dissatisfied by what they saw the general commercial manufacturers making. Taste was important for the first time. And so many are turning to homemade. So there's definitely a big strain and ethos to make your own baby food. But many still wanted the convenience of commercial baby food. And so you have small boutique baby food companies.
I want to one last time go back to our grid on page 10. So it stops at 2000. I don't suppose we know the average age at which infants are getting solid foods for 2010. Do we know that yet?
Well, the advice is 4 to 6 months.
Which is still where it is.
Yeah. And that has not really changed. However, I think what's happening today is something really interesting. The practice that's been in favor for a while is introduce food slowly, one at a time, wait a week in between foods and check for food allergies. And some pediatricians are saying, if you wait and introduce foods 1 week at a time, the kid's going to be, you know, 15 months old before they've had kind of a decent array of foods. Better to introduce foods earlier and more frequently and help further promote that palate development for a wide variety of flavors, tastes, and textures than to wait. It's really an interesting potential reversal of introducing solids, and we'll kind of see where it plays out.
Amy Bentley is the author of Inventing Baby Food, Taste, Health, and the Industrialization of the American Diet. She's also an associate professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. More conversations like this one at eartheats.org. A shout out to our team, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. And thanks for your company today. Till next time, cheers. I'm Annie Corrigan.